Hello and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus and on the web at KUCI.org. So tell all your friends in other areas of the country and world to tune in because they can listen from wherever they sit on the planet. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Writers on Writing, as usual, features authors, editors, poets, and literary agents discussing the art and the business of writing. Today, my guest is Luis Alberto Urrea. He's a 2005 Pulitzer Prize finalist for nonfiction and member of the Latino Literature Hall of Fame. He's a prolific and acclaimed writer who uses his dual culture life experiences to explore greater themes of love, loss, and triumph. He was born in Tijuana, Mexico, to a Mexican father and an American mother. He's published extensively in all the major genres and is currently published by Little Brown and Company. He is critically acclaimed, 11 books, and an award-winning poet and essayist. The Devil's Highway, his 2004 nonfiction account of a group of Mexican immigrants lost in the Arizona desert, won the 2004 Lannan Literary Award and was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize and the Pacific Rim Kiriyama Prize. A national bestseller, The Devil's Highway was also named a best book of the year by the LA Times, the Miami Herald, the Chicago Tribune, the Kansas City Star, and many other publications. Luis's first book, Across the Wire, was named New York Times Notable Book and won the Christopher Award. He also won a 1999 American Book Award for his memoir, Nobody's Son, Notes from an American Life. And in 2000, he was voted into the Latino Literature Hall of Fame following the publication of Vatos. His book of short stories, Six Kinds of Sky, was named the 2002 Small Press Book of the Year in Fiction by the editors of Foreword magazine. He has also won a Western States Book Award in Poetry for The Fever of Being and was in the 1996 Best American Poetry Collection. Luis is here today to talk about The Hummingbird's Daughter, and we're going to talk about The Devil's Highway, too, and all sorts of other things. But it is the culmination of 20 years of research and writing. The historical novel tells the story of Teresa Urrea, sometimes known as the Saint of Cabora and the Mexican Joan of Arc. He now lives in Naperville, Illinois, where he is a professor of creative writing at the University of Illinois, Chicago. Hi, Luis.
Hi, how are you?
Great. My goodness, you have been busy.
Yeah, I sounded pretty prolific listening to you talk about all the stuff.
Yeah, and it sounds like you're just so, so experienced in so many different genres. Will you talk a bit about that, how you got your start and how it has led to The Hummingbird's Daughter?
Oh, my. Well,
we have time.
Yeah, gosh. I wanted to be a poet at first. I was a mediocre student at best, I would say, and in high school and middle school, what we used to call junior high back in the ancient days. And there was a teacher in junior high school who urged me to, because I didn't like poetry, urged me to read Stephen Crane's poems. And I had not enjoyed Stephen Crane's Red Badge of Courage. I found it very difficult for my little Southern California, you know, hangout boy mind to comprehend. But I got the collected poems, and it was a revelation to me. I'd never read anything like that before. And I knew right away I wanted to do that. I didn't know how, but I wanted to do that. And I think that was expanded by you know, such San Diego delights as Jim Morrison,
mm-hmm.
Leonard Cohen albums and Neil Young albums. I thought, whatever those guys are doing, that's what I want to do.
Sure.
And in high school, I began writing, I think, in earnest. I didn't have any musical talent, though I wanted to be a rock star like every other kid I knew, so I ended up writing lyrics for all the musicians I knew. And that kept me quite busy through high school and college. And, right about college, I started realizing that I really wanted to do even more than be a poet was to be a great novelist. I thought, well, I think I can do this. And it was always, a sort of a sense that writing is some kind of secret ritual that only I had figured out that could somehow magically change the world. I certainly thought that certain sentences I had written would, you know, change the course of history, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And in my senior year in college, my father died in a bad accident in Mexico with all kinds of horrible, nasty details at the hands of the Mexican police and so forth. And, you know, I was pretty severely traumatized by his death, part of his death being the rich experience of having the Mexican police sell me his corpse. He died bringing money to the United States for my graduation. I was going to be the first of the family to graduate from college. So I ended up spending the graduation money he went to retrieve that ultimately killed him to buy his corpse.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's one of those incredible, you know, writerly events in a way. But I was really, there was no way I was going to go to graduate school. I was a college senior. And I managed to graduate, and I had met Ursula Le Guin, thank God. She was my visiting writing teacher my last semester when my father was killed. And Ursula took a story I had written about my dad and published it. It was my first real publication in one of her anthologies. So, you know, I always tip my hat to her because she found me and sort of shaped me up and sent me out into the world.
Yes.
Shortly after studying with Ursula, I was invited to join some missionaries who were going to Tijuana regularly to help the poor. And I, having been born in Tijuana, felt like, well, you can't show me anything about Tijuana. We've lived there forever. I was born there. I'm the expert. And, of course, they took me to things that I had never, ever imagined. In fact, watching the hurricane catastrophe in New Orleans today, there's scene after scene reminiscent of what I saw in Tijuana. You know, I ended up spending years living with the people in the Tijuana garbage dumps who picked trash to live. Believe it or not, this is all heading toward the answer to your question.
But, I trust you.
Yeah, I'm going there. But, you know, so I was there and I was experiencing that. Needless to say, dealing with people who, to live, have to eat the dead dogs that the city dumps in their garbage dump, you know, really put a crimp in my pursuing a literary career. And I ended up keeping journals of all this. And the minister that I was working for as a translator told me one day, you know, no one who has access to these shacks writes books, and you should write about what's happening to these people. And, you know, that just became kind of a calling to me to get a record of it. And in 1982, I finally couldn't take the strain of the endless violence and nightmares and horror. I was going there sometimes 5, 6, 7 days a week and coming home to San Diego to my rock and roll friends, you know, and we would hang out at an all-night donut shop in a scene out of Diner or something, you know, with all these cads hanging around. And I could not communicate to them what I had seen during the day. There was no way to make that world come into, you know, San Diego's rock and roll world. It just didn't work. And being the translator means that you hear every story and see every sight, no matter how awful. So I wrote to a friend of mine who was at Harvard teaching. He had been the sponsor professor when Le Guin came. At UCSD, by the way. And I told him, look, you know, I can't take it anymore. I've got to get out of here. Can you get me a job as a janitor? I would like to come and clean classrooms. And he was co-director of the expository writing program, and he wrote back and he said, well, I think I can get you a job. Send me 3 published pieces from lit journals and a bibliography of anything else you might have published. And I sent it to him, thinking I was applying for a job as a janitor. And in my ignorance, I would tell all my pals in San Diego, you know, Harvard is so exclusive that to be a janitor, you got to be a published poet, man. and I was hired to teach writing, which was a miracle that I can't quite fathom yet. There's no way I would have gotten into Harvard as a student, but I did as, to go teach writing, figure that. But, you know, when I got there, I had all these journals of this experience, and I had hundreds of photographs, and the children at the orphanages would write me letters, and, you know, my friends would do things like go to the my favorite taco stand in Tijuana and just tape record 90 minutes of the taco chef making tacos and send me these tapes. And I was just, you know, I was alone for the first time, and I had some pocket money literally for the first time in my life. And I had this incredible job, and this whole new world opened to me. But at night, you know, in my isolation, I would listen to these tapes and look at their pictures. And I started trying to write that first book in 1983, and it took 10 years to publish. No one would publish it. I was rejected nonstop from 83 to 93 and revised it many, many, many times. And I was even told by a New York editor at one point, nobody cares about starving Mexicans. It's a direct quote. And I thought, well, somebody will care if you just publish this book. I know someone will care. And like I said, it took 10 years to get it published, which is a great lesson to my writing students now, because they think, you know, well, I take a class and I'll be famous.
Mm-hmm.
And I tell them, you know, you've got to wear them down sometimes. But I had a mission in a way that took me outside of myself. You know, I probably never forgot the egomania involved sometimes in being a writer, but I had that drive to tell the story of the people who were voiceless, and I wasn't going to rest until somebody finally told it. And, you know, when the time came for a publisher to accept it, which was Anchor Books, one of the things they did was ask me, what are 12 reasons that we should publish this book? You know, hoping I would know Chicano studies departments that would buy it or something. And I was so burned out after 10 years that one of my answers was, you should publish this because God wants you to. and I think for whatever reason they took a shot, you know.
And that was across the wire?
Across the wire, yeah, and it's, I don't know, 17 printings, so I used to boast I got a printing for every year it was rejected, but now I'm about every year and a half, so you know, for every half a year, I guess. So I'm doing all right with that.
How do you write about such things? Oh, and let me say again that if you just tuned in, I am speaking with Luis Alberto Urrea, author of The Hummingbird's Daughter and The Devil's Highway, and he was just talking about Across the Wire. How do you write about such things as in Across the Wire and not, or The Devil's Highway, or any, so much of your writing, and not let it get to you? Or is it good if it does get to you? Does that make for more powerful writing? Is there any sort of line you have to stay behind?
Well, you know, certainly in Across the Wire by the Lake of Sleeping Children, they had gotten to me already. I had already been gotten to. So I was trying to get a record of what I saw and what happened and, you know, what the people were living. So it was inescapable, you know. And if I had known, I mean, if I had started out to write a book, I don't think I would have had the discipline or the strength to withstand the years of what I saw there. I really don't. That the book came out of the experience is a different matter. You know, I realized that I felt that those people were close to me. Some of them were like family to me. In fact, I'm godfather to some children there, you know, and some of those folks are still in touch with me, and my family and I help support one of the families at the dump still. You know, so it was a very deep personal entanglement, and that was a record I needed to tell. Devil's Highway, on the other hand, was more of a research project, and I didn't really, you know, I'm kind of known, I guess, for writing shocking books. I don't mean to. I'd like to write haiku all the time, you know. And I tell people when they come to my signings, they'll say, well, which one should I buy, Devil's Highway or Hummingbird's Daughter? And I say, well, do you want to be happy or unhappy? You know, do you want a dark book or a light book? And you know, that they'll trade off on what they buy. But I always, especially as a gift, I say, gosh, I wouldn't give anybody Devil's Highway personally. But you know, but that was oddly enough, Devil's Highway was the hardest book for me emotionally out of all of them. I think because of the haunting nature of what happened to these people and the way they died and all that sort of thing, you know. And But it was also exciting because I had all these personal revelations I wasn't expecting to have. You know, penetrating the world of the Border Patrol was something that was so amazing to me and something that I didn't even have any idea what I was getting into when I started. I mean, I knew what I was getting into with the undocumented, and I knew what I was getting into with awful death, and I even knew what I was getting into with the smugglers because I've had tangential experience with that much of my life. But the Border Patrol, that was something new to me. So that part was fun, and I ended up kind of hanging on to that to keep me afloat, you know, in times when it was just overwhelming.
In Devil's Highway, it seems that you also, and I don't know if this is true, but it seems that you played against a certain stereotype of Border Patrol.
Right.
Talk about that.
Well, you know, being a Tijuana boy, I mean, I was born in Tijuana, and I was, you know, much of my early life was in Southeast San Diego and barrio and ghetto life, and then, you know, finally kind of moving away from that. But, you know, I had always just seen the Border Patrol with through angry sort of Mexican-American Chicano eyes, you know, my enemy, my people's enemy, you know, that sort of thing. And having several relatives who are undocumented, I shan't name names, but, you know, I just had a real personal feeling about them. And much of it, I think, was a cliche. I mean, you know, and they had a cliched imagination of what I would be, too. You can imagine some writer with a Hispanic name who shows up out of the blue trying to find out their secrets. They thought, well, heck no, we're not going to let this guy in. And they, in fact, closed ranks for 4 months, wouldn't let me in. I tried everything. It was a real test of wills, I think, between the Border Patrol and myself, whether they would give me access or not. And, you know, culminating in this awful moment when I thought they were going to open their doors to me, so I stupidly dragged my family with me to Tucson, Arizona, thinking, well, you guys can frolic while I go on patrol. And we ended up waiting for days in a hotel getting these calls from the Washington, you know, powers that be, that put me off till the very last day that I was supposed to go on. And then they called me and said, well, gosh, you've run out of time, and we're going to do a kindness here and deny your application because you haven't left us enough time to represent ourselves well. So next time, you know, let us know with enough time. And I had hit a wall finally of bureaucratic genius, you know, and I told the guy, but I started applying 4 months ago. How much time do you need? So my response was, I always joke in readings, my response was the poet's response, you know, oh, woe is me. All is lost. My career is over. And my wife, who's an investigative journalist, you know, when things like that happen, those guys pick up the phone and start harassing people. And that's what she did. She started calling all the Border Patrol numbers she could find until, you know, the genius of the simple answer, I'm always complex and we must go to Washington. And she just called Yuma Sector, which is the actual sector that did the rescue. And those guys are kind of cowboy down there, you know. And they said, yeah, why not? Send them down. I could not believe my ears after 4 months of this other stuff. So I thought, well, let's get going, man. I can't waste a second. So I went down there immediately, you know, and they weren't completely welcoming. I liken it to trying to enter a Joseph Wamba book, you know. If you show up at the New Centurions, you know, and you've got an earring, and they're like, what the hell is this? And they kind of got in my face a little bit. But one of the supervisory agents took me under his wing, and then I started learning that if I was going to write a real book, an affecting book that was honest, I would understand that these agents are human beings also. And that was, I hate to admit it because it's so simple, isn't it? But they're human beings. And, you know, I felt this blast. It was an epiphany, you know, like if you wrote a James Joyce story about the desert or something, that's what happened. Because I thought, oh, my God, I was going to write this book, and I was trying to claim humanity for the victims when never thinking of the humanity for these men who actually rescued the people who didn't die. So, you know, the simplest answers, like I say, are sometimes brilliant, and that was what gave me a good book.
Yeah, so then The Devil's Highway, obviously then took off in a different direction.
Yeah, it really did. It really did. And, you know, it was, I mean, it was accidentally sly on my part, because when I embraced those officers, I started learning stuff that I would have never learned otherwise. And that was really great. And there was a lot of kindness shown to me by a lot of people who didn't need to. I was given materials that no one else had ever seen, and just really wonderful stuff from people. I was kept from the actual survivors because they were involved in a civil lawsuit and a criminal suit, so their lawyers kept them from me. But I will say that I was given plenty of semi-secret material from them to help me write the book. So that was really amazing.
Hmm. Let's take a short break, and when we come back, we'll be back with Luis Alberto Urrea. He will read to us from The Devil's Highway, and a little bit later from The Hummingbird's Daughter. So everyone out there, stay tuned.
Come back, baby, please don't go. No, I love you, darling, hate to see you go. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. My heart's full of sorrow, mama, aching tears. Be gone 24 hours, child, seem like a thousand years. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time. One belt in a day. Let's talk it over before you go away. Come back, baby, let's talk it over one more time.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM 88.9. We are broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we have spent the first half hour with Luis Alberto Urrea, author of The Devil's Highway and The Hummingbird's Daughter. And he's back with us, but before we bring him back on, I want to say that the opinions and views that you hear on this show are those of me and my guest, and not those of the University of California, Irvine Regents. Hello. Gotta say it.
Yeah, gotta say it, yeah.
Will you read to us from The Devil's Highway?
Yeah. I can't believe you've gone a half hour already.
I know. It goes fast.
Is it okay to do two pages?
That'd be great.
Okay. This is just the opening of the book to give you a sense of the scenario of how it opens. Five men stumbled out of the mountain pass, so sunstruck that they didn't know their own names, couldn't remember where they'd come from, had forgotten how long they'd been lost. One of them wandered back up a peak. One of them was barefoot. They were burned nearly black, their lips huge and cracking, what paltry drool still available to them spewing from their mouths in a salty foam as they walked. Their eyes were cloudy with dust, almost too dry to blink up a tear. Their hair was hard and stiffened by old sweat standing in crowns from their scalps. Old sweat because their bodies were no longer sweating. They were drunk from having their brains baked in the pan. They were seeing God and devils, and they were dizzy from drinking their own urine. They were beyond rational thought. Visions of home fluttered through their minds. Soft green bushes, waterfalls, children, music. Butterflies the size of your hand, leaves and beans of coffee plants burning through the morning mist as if lit from within. Rivers, not like this place, where they'd gotten lost. Nothing soft here. This world of spikes and crags was as alien to them as if they'd suddenly awakened on Mars. They were walking now for water, not salvation, just a drink. They whispered it to each other as they staggered into parched pools of their own shadows, forever spilling downhill before them. They walked west, though they didn't know it. They had no concept anymore of destination. The only direction they could manage was through the gap they stumbled across as they cut through the granite mountains of southern Arizona. They came down out of the screaming sun and broke onto the rough plains of the Cabeza Prieta wilderness at the south end of the United States Air Force Barry Goldwater bombing range. The sun recommenced its burning. In many ancient religious texts, fallen angels were bound in chains and buried beneath a desert known only as desolation. This could be the place. In the distance, deceptive stands of mesquite trees must have looked like oases. Trees a quarter mile apart looked like a cool grove from a distance. Black ironwood stumps writhed from the ground, dead for 500 years. They had already been 2,000 years old when they died. It was a forest of eldritch bones. That's the beginning.
Thank you so much. That was Luis Alberto Urrea reading from The Beginning of the Devil's Highway, published by Little Brown. And it's coming out in paperback any day now.
Any day now, yeah. I think in a week or so, yes. Maybe two.
You may have left the world of poetry, but certainly poetry has not departed your writing. it's full of all sorts of poetic touches. And I wonder if that is something you're working on as you are writing or revising, or if that's just a part of you now and it just comes out.
Yeah, it's just my voice, I think. Mm-hmm. You know, I, in fact, if I try to be poetic, I think it's usually stilted and awful.
Talk about voice a bit.
Voice.
Yeah, it's one of those things. You know, I think beginning writers especially wonder about voice, how to have that in their own writing. And
yeah.
Often, you know, you see beginning writers working at imitating other writers that perhaps they idolize instead of turning inward.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. As I said earlier, I not only read Stephen Crane, I was Stephen Crane, I thought. And then I was Jim Morrison, and then I was Leonard Cohen, and then I was Richard Brautigan. And then I went to college, and I was Diane Wachowski. And, you know, I tried to be Garcia Marquez, and on and on. I thought I was Joan Didion, Annie Dillard, Ed Abbey. And finally, I thought I was Thomas McGuane for a long time. And then, you know, all those influences got absorbed and started expressing themselves in the strange synthesis that became my voice. And, you know, I realized, for example, the tone in Devil's Highway is, I can think of nothing else but kind of punk rock. You know, it's a little snotty in ways. You can't tell that from that opening because it's so dramatic. I don't make fun of the suffering of the people who suffer, but I do make some fairly savage fun of the entire scenario and situation in politics. And part of the reason for that is that it is absurd and stupid that people are suffering like this. And it makes the horror later, when you stop kidding, all the more shocking. But it has a definite difference in tone, I think, from Hummingbird's Daughter and some of my other work, which Hummingbird's Daughter is still lyrical. But they both, I think, you know, have, I guess, my attempt to be vivid and visual in what I write. Hummingbird's Daughter and Devil's Highway both, and I think many of my other books, are really attempts to capture the sound and tone of voice of those I hear and speak to. you know, Devil's Highway, much of it has the kind of reflected voice of the coyote smuggler himself or of the Border Patrol agent using their slang and their diction, which I think is fun.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in Hummingbird's Daughter, we're now working on all these weird translations. I've never had books in other countries before, and suddenly, you know, it's coming out in Israel in a Hebrew edition, which mm-hmm. is amazing, you know, or a German edition. And there are two Spanish editions. There's one coming out of Spain in proper Spanish. And then there's a Mexican and Chicano edition that's coming out from my cousin and me in, you know, New World Spanish.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole thing about voice is so interesting, I think, is that Hummingbird's Daughter is written in English, but it's a magic trick in that I was trying to capture in English the taste and feeling of Sinaloan Spanish. And when my cousin, who's the ambassador, just left, he was the ambassador to the Philippines for Mexico, he asked me, well, what are we reaching for this translation? And I said, we're trying to catch the sound of your dad and my dad sitting around smoking after a little cup of cognac, just shooting the bull in that particular Sinaloan, hilarious Spanish. And that's what we're trying to capture. So I wanted people to feel like they were, you know, reading Spanish or perhaps even an indigenous language, you know, Cajita or something, though it was in English. Mm-hmm. And so now the magic trick in the voice is in the translation to make it the actual product, you know, the actual sound.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah.
Now, The Hummingbird's Daughter is based on your great aunt Teresita.
Yeah.
Talk about that. How did this happen? Many years in the making?
Yeah, 20 years. Let me tell you that everything I've written has been a diversion from this book. 20, you know, it's been more than 20 years. I say 20 years because I began actual research in 85, but you know, it began when I was a little kid. It began in Tijuana, you know, listening to my Aunt Leticia, known as La Flaca. You know, and La Flaca would gather us together and tell us these stories. Many of them were obvious, you know, myth. Grandma had El Cucuy, the demon, living in her closet, you know, that kind of stuff. And amidst all these fabulous, rich, you know, Macondo-like stories we grew up in were these stories about my aunt. You got a yaki aunt, y la tía puede volar, you know, she says she can fly, and she can raise the dead, and she can heal the sick, y todo eso, you know, and I was like, wow, this is cool, but, you know, it was on the level of the devil living in grandma's closet. I didn't think it was true, and around about the time I started the missionary work, I was also TAing at a community college in San Diego, and the professor I was working for recognized my name immediately and said, are you related to the saint? And I said, what saint? He said, you know, the saint of Cabora. And I didn't even know what she was called or what her name was. I had just heard these tales. And he produced an essay by Carrie McWilliams about her. I was flabbergasted. I felt like I was the first person to ever discover she really did exist. And I Xeroxed it and distributed it to family members. But then, you know, years later, I found books about her, and I began a serious bunch of research, a lot of travel, a lot of reading and haunting archives and collecting a pretty big bibliography. And in 95, I realized that book learning alone wasn't going to cut it. And I went to Tucson to be closer to the Yaqui people. She was known as the Queen of the Yaquis by the white press, and found indigenous branches of my family that I had never met. One branch is Apache, and one branch is Yaqui, and the related tribe, which is Mayo. And in the Mayo branch of the family were medicine women who started teaching me the actual female sacredness, which is different from male's medicine.
Hmm.
And, you know, that was that from then till now. And it took me many, 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 I can't tell you how many, drafts to try and finally find the voice to tell the story in.
Now, it's a novel, not narrative nonfiction.
Right.
Talk about the decision behind that.
Yeah, I have a fairly glib answer to that, which is you cannot footnote a dream.
Mm.
So much of the work involved in this novel turned out to be research into shamanism and curanderismo and native religion and mysticism, and you know, much of it was done. I don't want to sound like a half-baked Carlos Castaneda wannabe, because I'm not, but a lot of this stuff was done through dream work and through ritual. The people said, do this, something will happen. And I started getting curious, you know, even though I knew that if the Baptist missionaries I used to work for saw me doing it, they'd probably burn me at the stake. But I would do it, and things happened. And I realized at a certain point that, you know, fiction was truer than nonfiction. And that there, I have a 58-page bibliography, you know, or bigger, and you know, a lot of nonfiction there. But I started understanding that if you want to get close to the heart and soul of these people, you might need a novel which tells a deeper truth sometimes, I think, than any essay can. And I got to know her in a sense that I could not prove. But when you live with somebody day and night for 20 years, you know, you read her letters and memoirs of people who know her, you start to see her and the people around her. So I just felt that, you know, partially it was that. And the other thing was that, you know, I come from a generation, I think, that still reveres the novel. And I feel like as a writer, for me, that would be the greatest accomplishment I could come up with, is if I could write a great novel. It's a very difficult thing, I think. And, you know, it's like, to me, it's my symphony, I guess, that I've composed. And I wanted to try to give her and my family the best I could do. And, you know, so some of those drafts were nonfiction, by the way. The novel won out during the battle. But I just wanted to see if I could stand up and launch a novel that I was proud of that maybe could make people dream. You know, it's part novel and part ritual. I designed it with some medicine people in a way that it's a little bit ritualistic, and that, you know, you get initiated first into the mysteries of their life and then live in it. So,
read to us from The Hummingbird's Daughter.
Oh gosh, okay.
And
well,
if you just tuned in, as I always say at this time, you're a little bit late, but we have about 10 or 15 minutes left with Luis Alberto Urrea, and he's about to read to us from The Hummingbird's Daughter, also published by Little Brown.
Yeah, okay, well, this is near the beginning, and Teresita's mother was a 14-year-old indigenous girl named Cayetana Chavez, and she was impregnated by the hacienda owner on the ranch where she worked, who was my ancestor, Tomas Urrea. And this is the morning of Teresita's birth, before Cayetana feels the birth pangs. Gives you a little taste of the world we're in. Cayetana greeted that dawn with a concoction made with coffee beans and burned corn kernels. As the light poured out of the eastern sea and splashed into windows from coast to coast, Mexicans rose and went to their million kitchens and cooking fires to pour their first rations of coffee. A tidal wave of coffee rushed west across the land, rising and falling from kitchen to fire ring to cave to ramada. Some drank coffee from thick glasses. Some sipped it from colorful gourds, rough clay pots that dissolved as they drank, or cones of banana leaf. Café negro, café with canela, café with goat's milk, café with a golden brown cone of piloncillo melting in it, like a pyramid engulfed by a black flood. Tropical café with a dollop of sugarcane rum coiling in it like a hot snake. Bitter mountaintop café that thickened the blood. In Sinaloa, café with boiled milk, its burned skin floating on top in a pale membrane that looked like the flesh of a peeled blister. The heavy-eyed stared into the round mirrors of their cups and regarded their own dark reflections. And Cayetana Chavez, too, lifted a cup, her coffee reboiled from yesterday's grounds and grits, sweet with spoons of sugarcane syrup and lightened by thin blue milk stolen with a few quick squeezes from one of the patron's cows. Every Mexican dreamed of one thing, and that was being a Mexican. They still spoke 1,000 languages, Spanish too, to be sure, but also a thicket of songs and grammars. Mexico, the sound of wind in ruins. Mexico, the waves rushing the shore. Mexico, the sand dunes, the snowfields, the steam of sleeping Popocatépetl. Mexico, across marijuana fields, tomato plants, avocado trees, the agave in the village of Tequila, Mexico.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
That was Luis Alberto Urrea reading from The Hummingbird's Daughter, published by Little Brown. Yeah, your writing is so tasty.
Thanks.
So many visceral qualities to it. Talk about the forming of this book, and again, did it go the way you thought it was going to go? Were there surprises along the way? Did you have a plot or an outline you followed and veered from it?
Well, here's the thing: when you write historical fiction, you're trapped by the history. So, you know, I wrote the book following the days of her life up to the midway point. I've signed the contract, by the way, to do the sequel, but that's a whole other animal. I always joked with my editor that this book would be 100 years of solitude and the next book would be ragtime. And I did not know how to write ragtime. I still don't. But, you know, she came to the United States and had a wild time here. But I also specifically chose to write about her early years because there's less known about some of those days. And I had a little freedom to exercise my imagination, although I followed historical data and dates and personages. And some of the surprises were amazing. One of the surprises is that people respond the most strongly, in my experience so far, to Huila, who's the old healer woman of the ranch who trained Teresita. Now, she was a real woman. The masters called her Maria Sonora, but her name was Huila, which in her language means skinny woman. And skinny woman trained Teresita, but, you know, Mexico being a patriarchal society and not sensitive to indigenous issues has erased her completely from the record. There's no record of anything about her except her name and that she taught Teresa, and that she was a ferocious woman who ran the entire domestic staff for the hacienda, but was actually the top medicine woman and midwife for the people. So in my studies with Esperanza Urrea, my cousin, the curandera, hechicera, in Tucson, it turns out that Esperanza, being from the Mayo tribe, is the granddaughter of a woman named Maclovia Moroyoki, and her father was Jose Maria Urrea. Maclovia Moroyoki is descended from the Mayo people's greatest war leader, Moroyoki, and Jose Maria was descended from Teresita. Maclovia Moroyoki was the full medicine woman of the village of El Jupa de Sonora, who trained Esperanza. So, miraculously, unexpectedly, I was given the personage of Huila in the personality of Maclovia. As I was writing this, I would say to Esperanza in great despair, I cannot find, you know, where to grab hold of this Huila character. And she'd say, wow, mijo, that's terrible. You know what Huila would say? I mean, what Maclovia would say. And I'd say, oh, really? That's interesting, you know. But I can't get Huila down. And she'd say, oh, well, you know what Maclovia did? I'd say, gee, that's amazing. I wish I could figure out Huila. Oh, it was when Maclovia did this. And it suddenly, you know, dawned on me that this woman was trying to tell me, here's your model. Here's your model. And I based Huila, who everybody's in love with, on the teachings and the medicine of Maclovia Moroyoki. Now, when I left Tucson, Esperanza gave me a photograph of Maclovia, who died in 1963. But more interestingly, she gave me her rebozo, her shawl, and she asked me to share Maclovia with the people I met. So on book tour, I take the shawl, and it's really weird, but I take it out of my book bag if it feels right. Some audiences you don't, but if it feels right, I take it out, and it's like a little shockwave goes through the crowd because the women there are so involved with her. And I put out the shawl, and people come and rather than ask for an autograph, ask if they can touch the shawl. It's a really special moment. And something I don't intrude on. I just stay out of their way. And, you know, but I've seen people cry when they put their hand on it. And that's really touching. And people have a connection to Teresita, too, that's so strong. You know, we, in our research, my wife and I found in a microfilm file an autographed photograph of hers that I've never seen elsewhere. And I had not seen her autograph, so we had postcards made of it. So we have what we call the postcard ministry, you know, where people go to my website, and if they request it, we'll mail it to them. And my God, we've sent hundreds of postcards to people. But it's so cool because the dialogue that's happening with readers is something I've never experienced, and it's really beautiful. I try really hard to answer everybody who sends an email, but sometimes I can't because it overwhelms me. But we do, you know, every couple of days, address, and I sign the postcards and send them to them because it's just so wonderful to have people respond to her. So in some sense, I feel like I'm doing my duty to her by bringing her back.
Oh, yeah, that's fascinating. And you know, something else, as you've been talking, I am thinking of people, again, writers, beginning writers who are trying to second-guess the publishing industry in terms of, you know, how to get published and on and on. And you are such an example of following those projects that you need to follow for yourself as a writer and finding success that way and not selling yourself out while being able to have that.
Yeah, you know, the thing is, I wrote to live, honestly. I mean, I teach creative writing, so I know a lot of people who want to be famous. And though that is part of it, it's on some level you realize that's a very childish part of it. Because frankly, fame isn't that much fun. What little I have of it, aside from talking to people that really are wonderful, you know, I know really famous people and they're miserable. The point is the work. And if I didn't have writing, I might have died. You know, I came from very tough situation in my life, and you know, writing has given me everything. I mean, I could argue that Teresita has given me everything because I've worked my whole life trying to figure her story out to bring it to you. But everything good in my life, without exception, is because of writing. And I'll give you two quick examples. My wife and I, we're together because she was a reporter who did an interview with me, and we fell in love. My daughter happened because I got to teach writing workshops in Provence, and you know what happens when you're in France. So, you know, and I would tell people, you know, if you are the kind of person who stayed up under a blanket with a flashlight to read Moby Dick or Nancy Drew or Ray Bradbury stories, you know who you are. And the important thing is that work. It's not the fame, or it's not selling it. It's getting the work out. And I would tell people what I tell my students, which is sometimes you have to wear the bastards down. Sometimes everybody tells you to change what you do and change who you are if you want to make it. Sometimes you wait them out.
Mm-hmm. That's so true. That is so true. Ah, what are you reading now? Do you read while you're writing?
I read a lot.
What are you reading now?
You know, when I'm stoking up the engine, I read poetry.
Mm-hmm.
I've been wandering around here saying, damn it, I can't write. It's all over. I'm burned out. And I, you know, pick up my Zen poetry. I'm rereading a lot of haiku, which really gets me charged up. I'm really good friends with John Connolly, the Irish mystery writer, and he's just sent me his new book called The Black Angel, so I'm going to read some really creepy, hard-boiled detective fiction. you know, I read voraciously all the time, all the time.
And gosh, you know, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about teaching, and we have a minute left, and I just wanted to ask you, as you know, as an author, what does teaching do for you?
It depends. You know, teaching is very difficult at the academic level for me because it really sucks out energy. But when I get to teach things like workshops or visiting things at writing retreats where I talk to people who write to live, not for a grade or fame, then I it's like I learn. You know, I get the chance to feel my heart expand with joy because I can help somebody tell a story they have to tell.
Hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Let's see. Another minute. You know, too much here. You're going to have to come back when The Hummingbird's Daughter goes into paperback.
Yeah, let's do it. It's coming out in spring.
We'll have to do it again. Maybe last words, any more words of wisdom, pearls for the writers who are listening.
Words of wisdom, I'll tell you one thing I learned, and there's not enough time to get into it, but that's okay because it sounds new agey, but it's not. My teachers taught me that as a writer, they wanted me to study with them because they said my job was to be a healer like she was, and I told them I'm not. I don't have any sign of being able to heal anybody, and they said in that case, you must do it through literature because literature is healing. And that in some deep sense, in simple sense, changed my life forever.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming on the show and continued good luck with your books. And
thank you.
You have a movie coming out, don't you? The Devil's
Highway? Yeah, they start filming Devil's Highway in October.
Excellent. We'll look for that, too.
Okay.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
That was Luis Alberto Urrea, author of The Hummingbird's Daughter and The Devil's Highway, published by Little Brown. And author of so much else. So check these books out. His website is luisurrea.com. That's luisurrea.com. A lot going on that website. All right. We are at the end of our time. If you want to know more about this show, you can go to my website, which is penonfire.com. You can email me from there if you want to be on my weekly email list. And next Wednesday night, I will be in Santa Monica at the Barnes & Noble there on the promenade giving a talk called, what is it called? 7:30 next Wednesday night. It's called How to Keep Your Butt in the Chair When the Rest of You Wants to Get Up. And if you're in the LA area, come by. I'm going to leave you with a quote from The Hummingbird's Daughter. It's the beginning, the epigraph says, "Truth is everything. Of truth, I have no fear. In truth, I see no shame." That's by Teresita Urrea. Thank you for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 FM KUCI. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett. Until next week.